Keeneland Life's Work Project, Number 3, Ted Bassett. Anyone privileged to know this gentleman will very soon know where I'm going with this. The Eclipse Awards, 1984. He has been invited to announce the winner of a Horse of the Year duel between Slewer Gold and the venerable gelding John Henry, who has just turned 10. He finds that the envelope is stuck fast and spends a few awkward seconds trying to tear it open. As the tension rises, he finally produces the card. And he doesn't even announce the horse's name. He simply says, "Like old wine," and everyone is on their feet, applauding the horse, who just gets better every year. Ron McAnally, the trainer of John Henry and a good friend, bounds up there and approaches him. "For goodness sake, I nearly had a heart attack waiting for you to open that thing." But just as there was no need to name John Henry that day, 35 years ago, nor can anyone really need to be told which pillar of the American turf, in meanwhile advancing to the age of 98, has himself only been fortified, never eroded by the passing of the years, both in the vigour of his character and the esteem of an industry. It barely seems a figure of speech, in fact, to describe James E. Bassett III as a pillar of the American turf. His whole bearing remains so upright that it condenses not only the indelible stamp of his wartime service with the US Marines, but also the authority and integrity he seamlessly transferred to civilian life. And that's why the scope of his reflections falls far beyond the customary remit of this series. Yes, there were always horses lurking in the background. His mother's grandfather was a Confederate general who bred trotters when he returned to Kentucky after the Civil War with a daughter of the governor of Mississippi, which, as Bassett says wryly, did not impede his progress. And Bassett's own father, having lost a banking job after the crash, found work helping to run Jock Whitney's bluegrass farms, ending up, in fact, on the original board of directors at Keeneland. But that was never any kind of clue to Bassett's eventual destiny, which would summon him to the world of thoroughbreds only by the most circuitous of paths.
My sort of career has been rather nomadic. I've been very fortunate that people have tolerated me. I was a beneficiary of a sort of a strange series of coincidences and happenstances. I would be among the list of missing persons if both in the Kentucky State Police, Keeneland, and the Breeders' Cup, if there hadn't been some innate problem.
He had come within an ace of being missing once and for all back in Okinawa. At daybreak, he was heading a patrol as a rifle platoon leader in Baker Company, 1st Battalion, 4th Marines, a proud association.
It's the only Marine regiment in the 246 years of Marine Corps history that ever lost its colors. Only Marine Corps regiment that ever has a record of surrendering. And this was on Bataan. And MacArthur surrendered to the United States forces in the Marine Corps, and the force was there. And many of the surviving members of the force died on the Bataan death march. Well, when they located, when they restored and they brought the raider battalions into the fort, it gave the whole thing a feeling. And, you know, here I was just greener in a gourd. We were on Okinawa. It was an early morning patrol that we were on. We were moving up through a sort of a little bit of a valley, and we were ambushed by the Japanese. How in the world I was hit in my hand. My critics after the Bassett, "You must have been waving your hand up like this in the air at the Japanese." I said, "Hell, I don't know what the hell I was doing, but I got shot through the hand." And and I got mortar in my knee. I've often thought I could have gotten that bullet right there and I've been gone, and it was just a fortuitous circumstance.
That life-saving, split-second twist of fate took its place in what Bassett recognizes as a life-changing experience overall with the Marine Corps.
It just never left. You know, it was that feeling, it was a swagger, it made a change in my life. It made a change in the commitment. I'm not waving a flag, but you had a feeling, can do. You know, you had a feeling. And so, and these other little things that I've been involved with, the state police. Look, listen, if I'd gone into the state police as a Yale graduate, I don't think I'd gotten very far. But I went in there as a combat Marine and wounded and decorated.
In the meantime, there had been the DMOB reward of young married life in post-war New York. South Pacific, My Fair Lady, $6 orchestra seats. He was a traveling salesman for a Whitney newsprint company in the golden age of family-owned, community-oriented newspapers. But after an unusual interlude for a Yale graduate as a tobacco farmer, Bassett and his wife Lucy were seeking a rather less literal way of going back to their Kentucky roots, and he found it in the crucible of the civil rights era in the state police.
The state police, when I went down there in the 60s, the mid-60s, the nation was divided, not only school busing, open housing and whatnot, but the equal pay, the riots, Watts, Alabama, Detroit, Rochester. The perception of law enforcement in those days was at a very low ebb. You had Bull O'Connor in Birmingham with police dogs attacking the black mothers and the small children. You had the high-pressure water hoses and tear gas turned on these same people. You see the bodies rolling over from the pressure.
When he took over the local force, Bassett found morale in the ranks at rock bottom. He pressed for better, both in the caliber of his officers and in their rate of pay. Worked to improve training and public trust. One of the first things he did was negotiate some billboards pro bono.
We had this good-looking, clean-cut, waist-high state trooper with his hat and whatnot. And big red letters across the billboard was, "It's my job to help you." And then we had the telephone number of the state police post in that particular district. But that was our first step of trying to say, friend, not foe.
Bassett brought down the barriers. Troopers were sent into schools. Groups of citizens were taken to the pistol range or up in the helicopter. Borrowing the long grey line from West Point, he had the cars changed from blue and white to grey. There was a big spat when he brought in the blue light. The sheriffs wanted it too, and Bassett said no. These were the very people, untrained, political appointees, from whom he needed to distinguish his own men. He set up what is now a major academic program at a local university, albeit he initially had to drag his men there with pay bonuses. To get speakers from the FBI, he even went to see J. Edgar Hoover and found him to be a horse player.
That school over there now is a real factor. You know, in the old days, on firearm training with a local police department, you go to old Joe, took you to city dump, throw a coke cam up in the air and shoot that.
In establishing a reputation as a troubleshooter with the state police, Bassett caught the attention of a very different institution. Very different, but with one or two parallel issues in terms of a certain staleness. A need for structural and cultural adaptation to a rapidly changing environment. Keeneland.
It wasn't a personnel problem, so to speak, but suddenly in the post-Depression years, Lexington began to grow. The interstates opened up both Ohio and Tennessee, and Keeneland was not prepared for this growth. And then there's a combination, too, of the Sir Ivor opening up the international market for us.
Bassett was so intrigued by the potential that he turned down three times the money from a somewhat less august local brand. Former Governor John Brown, who founded Kentucky Fried Chicken, still teases Bassett.
John Ray will say today, you know, the luckiest thing that ever happened to Kentucky Fried Chicken was that you didn't take the job. I said, now, John, wait a minute. What do you mean by that? He said, anybody stupid enough to turn down a job that paid $100,000 a year and an option to buy 5,000 shares of stock in Kentucky Fried and took a job at Canaan for 30 is not smart enough to run Kentucky Fried Chicken. And to this day, whatever he tells that goddamn story over and over again. But it's true.
As it was, he joined Keeneland at a time when the whole bloodstock market was on the brink of such seismic change that even its oldest hands were going to start afresh, to learn new rules, new ambitions, new names.
This was such an exciting time for us. We were like babes in the wood and in many ways. We didn't know the difference between a Frank and a hot dog.
French trainer Alec Head came in and tried to explain.
They came in complaining. You know, our auctions, we sell somewhere around 30 to 35 horses an hour. You have to be on your toes or you're going to miss it. We were generally unaware of the language difficulties. American auction pace versus the European is much faster. Most of it was generated from selling cattle and tobacco. Our old auctioneer, George Swinebroad, the old historic famous auctioneer here at Keeneland, was fundamentally was a cattle and tobacco auctioneer, and he was selling 15, 20, 30 cattle in a matter of 30 minutes. You had to listen. You had to comprehend what he meant.
But so too did Keeneland need to listen. Head's bewilderment caused them to set up a bid display board, which would in time serve as the ultimate symbol of the market boom, when the first ever $10 million bid, exceeding the seven digits available, caused the screen to go blank. That whole melodrama, with the MacToon brothers duking it out with Coolmore, had come out of nowhere, or Dubai, which then amounted to much the same thing.
Where is Dubai? I mean, we were that sort of uninformed. They want to take over the 12th floor of the Hyatt and their first visit here. And they called the local Hyatt and said, do you know these people? I said, no. Well, how do you spell the name? M.A. Matuma. No, I've never heard of them. But they were very interesting, very, very low-key, making little or no demands. They had all sorts of British representatives that came with them and helped pave the way. Looking back on those days, it was almost like an adventure movie. People from around the world. Those bidding contests were tense, and in the silence in the entire pavilion, I have 10.1, 10.0, 10.2, and everybody hanging on, and Sangster bidding, Wayne Lucas bidding, and it was like a little miniature boxing match. So I was very fortunate to be a minuscule part of bystander looking on, seeing it. It was like a cast of characters coming in here.
But that had been the case from the outset. He remembers an earlier record at his very first July sale, a $405,000 bid by an Italian-American businessman from Virginia, trumping none other than Charles Engelhart. The next day, Bassett saw this unknown gentleman in the sales pavilion, introduced himself, and thanked him for his support.
And I said, by the way, Mr. Rosso, we do not have a financial report on you. Would you be kind enough to advise how you plan to play? He was about 5'6" or 7". with that, he looked at me in a sort of a quizzical, demanding way, and he reached in his pocket, and he took out four cashier checks for $100,000 and threw them at me. Is that enough? And with that, he turned and walked away. I felt like about 2 inches high, but I got down on my hands and knees and picked those checks up and took them in the office.
From Signor Rosso to the Queen of England, Bassett has held his head high among them all. Actually, dropping a trophy in front of the Queen at Ascot one day contributed to his longevity, as what he presumed to be persistent bruising on his toe turned out to be a melanoma that he would otherwise have overlooked. On another occasion, he was asked to present the Melbourne Cup, because Australia's Labour Prime Minister had refused the dress code of top hat and tails. But Bassett conducts himself in exactly the same way with royalty or those who daily serve him breakfast in the Keeneland Track kitchen, ever courteous, ever respectful of the true riches of human nature, which he knows have nothing to do with your bank balance. For he has always adhered to the marine principle of leadership, which is actually service. Put your men first, and they will see how to do the same for others. Though subsequently enlisted to bring the same team spirit to the Breeders' Cup, Bassett remains ever the presiding spirit at Keeneland, which he views as a repository and symbol of beauty, tradition, and service.
It's challenged over 85 years, emphasizing quality over quantity, asceticism over commercialism, maintaining its unique position in the community. Keeneland is more than just a racing and sales organization. We look on ourselves really as a responsible, caring citizen. And I'm fortunate as hell to have the opportunity to live in this community, to live in something like Central Kentucky. It's not only just the beauty of the place, it's the beauty of the people. The people here in Kentucky and Central Kentucky are caring people, kind people, thoughtful.
The paradox of Bassett's time here is that he had to preserve everything implied by the Keeneland name, its sober and reflective sense of heritage, through an era of giddy change, both on the track and in the sales ring.
We try to set the standard. Every time a new idea comes along, a new fangled idea, how to improve racing, how to get the fans out here, I always felt that the answer was flex, not cave. Look at it, try to see what's good that you can adopt and use, but don't cave in and throw everything out that you've done. And this is sort of the challenge as the new administrations come on. They all like these new ideas. Oh, they're doing this in New York, or they're doing this in California or whatnot. But the idea of beauty, tradition, location sort of keeps intertwining. The purpose of it that we had here was not trying to wring every last goddamn dollar out, but do it in a pristine way that reflects the traditions of racing.